From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, film festival season is quickly approaching, and the programmers in Venice and Toronto have teased out some of their big titles. Then Alamo Drafthouse founder Tim League gives a tour of his new downtown LA movie theater complex, and he tells me why this location will let you take a movie home with you.
I was a child of the 80s, and the video store experience was really important to me and kind of developing me as a movie nerd.
And we'll tell you how Quentin Tarantino and his crew recreated 1969 Hollywood for his new film. All that coming up on The Frame.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
At the end of August and into early September, there are three big film festivals in Venice, Telluride, and Toronto. The festivals are the first chance that movie studios have to get exposure for their important fall releases, and if they're lucky, start laying the groundwork for a possible Academy Award. Both the Venice and Toronto festivals recently announced their lineups, and the news out of Italy immediately prompted some complaints. I spoke with Rebecca Keegan, the senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter, for some perspective on the festivals, and she began by explaining what makes the Venice event unique.
Venice is predominantly about international audiences and critics. It's become more important in recent years as it sort of usurped some of the stature that Cannes once had, partly because of its time in the year and partly because it accepts Netflix films, which Cannes does not.
One of the things that was notable about the films in competition at Venice is there's just two female directors in the Venice competition, and Roman Polanski's latest film, An Officer and a Spy, was also selected for competition. We should note that Roman Polanski has avoided the United States for decades after pleading to unlawful sex with a minor. He's also been expelled from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So how did that lineup go over with people back here in the States? Only two female directors, but Roman Polanski among the men.
Yeah, it's a big warm hug for women, isn't it? It's what, the interesting thing about Venice is they had a really low bar to clear because last year they only had one female director. So they've doubled their representation to two, which is still not that much. And I think is definitely an issue that people think about here in the United States, and they're starting to think about it more in Europe, too.
One of the things that is notable about the Telluride Film Festival is they don't announce the films that are playing there until you arrive in Colorado over Labor Day weekend. But Toronto has started to announce some of its main titles, and it feels like there are a lot more what we'll call big Hollywood films. There's Mariel Heller's new movie with Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers. Todd Phillips from the Hangover movies has a movie with Joaquin Phoenix playing the Joker. There's the adaptation of Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. It seems not only a little bit more American, but much more studio-friendly than, say, Venice is.
Toronto's definitely the most populous of the festivals. Yeah, I mean, Toronto is the festival that accepts the most movies in terms of the number of movies, and it also sort of unveils them in the most populous way with these big screenings open to the public.
One of the things that I think is unavoidable is that even though we're many months away from the Oscar nominations, for better or worse, Hollywood's awards season really begins at these three festivals. It's where movies like Roma, Star is Born, The Favorite, and eventual Best Picture winner Green Book all premiered. So why are these festivals so important in the Oscar race? And how much jockeying is there even between the festivals about getting what they think are the best films?
A lot of jockeying, and the studios definitely try to sort of pick the right lane for their film. If you think about a movie like Green Book that won the Audience Award at Toronto last year and became a kind of surprise Best Picture winner, there's no question that that campaign got one of its biggest talking points at that film festival, and that Universal, the company that released it, definitely chose the right place to unveil it to people. So the festivals are sort of the way that studios and filmmakers kind of signal what these movies are. They give people a glimpse at the performances that they hope will eventually catch interest and affection from the Academy.
We're talking with Rebecca Keegan at The Hollywood Reporter about the three big film festivals this fall in Venice, Telluride, and Toronto. And not every movie that plays at any of these festivals is going to end up being an Academy Award contender. So how important is it that other movies get some sort of kind of momentum, even if it's not awards momentum, coming out of Toronto? Is it important that these movies play these festivals and get kind of commercial momentum in addition to critical momentum?
It is, although it's also a risk. I mean, one thing that can happen when you play a festival weeks before you actually open for audiences is that you can get some really grumpy reviews. So, yes, you're screening before these big audiences and you've got the red carpets and the press conferences, but you also have the potential to flop big. So there's a risk for studios when they go there. It definitely signals to me that Warner Brothers has some faith in The Joker beyond just being a movie that will appeal to sort of comic book fans if they're taking it to these festivals.
There will be additional titles that will be announced for the Toronto International Film Festival. And as I said, Telluride won't tell us what's going to play there till we get there over Labor Day weekend. But I think it's fair to say that there are going to be films that have already been announced, like Noah Baumbach's new film. Edward Norton has directed a film. There's a movie about Judy Garland that's going to be in Toronto. Are there certain things that you are especially interested in checking out over the next month or so?
Yeah, there are a couple of movies coming to Toronto that I'm super curious about. One is a movie called Jojo Rabbit, which is directed by Taika Waititi, and he wrote and stars as Hitler in the movie. It's a Fox Searchlight movie. Sounds like to have a very sort of edgy, interesting tone. That's one I'll be curious to see how it plays to audiences in Toronto. I'm also very excited about the Tom Hanks' Mr. Rogers movie, which Sony is bringing to the festival.
I think it's also important, too, that you can have a film like A Star is Born that plays at the Toronto Film Festival, and it leaves Canada with everybody thinking it is the film to beat in the Academy Awards. It ends up doing really well commercially, but it doesn't end up really crushing it at the Oscars. Is it often the case that what all the prognosticators say at these festivals isn't exactly true?
Yeah, you know, award season is a marathon, not a sprint, and it's not scientific, no matter how much people would like to pretend that it is. So it's, I have to say, at this time last year, Green Book was nowhere on my radar screen at all, and it went on to win Best Picture. So these festivals sort of set the table, but really what happens come Oscar Sunday is anybody's guess.
And I think I will be seeing you in Telluride, even though I guess we'll find out when we get there what we're going to see.
Yeah, bring your oxygen canisters, if only for me.
Okay. Rebecca Keegan is the senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, we tour a new movie complex with amenities designed to get you out of the house. Downtown LA just got a new multiplex, and it's not just a place to check out the latest Marvel blockbuster. It's the latest outpost of Texas-based chain Alamo Drafthouse. Company's CEO Tim League told me this isn't his first California theater, though. That was a 500-seat art house cinema in Bakersfield. I asked him how that went.
Oh, we failed miserably. I was 24, got into the movie business with zero experience. You know, we lasted for 2 years. We lived there. We lived behind the screen, and it taught us the business. And we were able to escape.
League is known for not favoring blockbusters in his programming approach, and that was clear standing in front of the Alamo's marquee when I visited earlier this week. The Lion King was there, but it was right alongside art house documentaries like Hail Satan.
We do like The Lion King, and well, I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. I can't say if I like it or not.
If you saw the old one, you've seen the new one.
So we want to show the kind of diversity of our tastes. So from documentaries, foreign language films, independents, but also in amongst the Star Wars and the Harry Potters of the world. We like them all. And so part of the design of this theater was to have 12 screens, a lot of screens, but pretty small seat counts. So for something like Midsommar, for example, I really love the film, and you know, my hope would be that we can hang on to that for 5 or 6 weeks and just keep it on a split schedule. And
Booksmart.
Now seating for Booksmart.
So Booksmart is a great example of a movie that I have to say I was stumped. It was well reviewed, certainly counter-programming to a lot of summer blockbusters, and basically died its opening weekend. So when you look at a movie like that,
How does it fit into what you want to do at Alamo and what you think the audience might be missing because it's probably out of most theaters already?
Well, I could talk a lot about Booksmart, honestly, because I think it did pretty decent numbers. I think the death of Booksmart has been overstated, from my opinion, and the fact that we can now play it, you know, a month and a half after the launch and still get really excited, interested audiences speaks to the power of the film. I think it's going to be around for a little while, and it's established itself as a bit of a cult favorite.
So I want to ask you about where we are, not just in downtown Los Angeles in this interesting development called The Block with no K, but I'm looking at your ticket counter, and over the heads of the ticket sellers is a bar, and it looks like some people are eating food. There's a video shop, there's tchotchkes, you can get a little plush Godzilla toy, some snugglies for your drinks. This whole area, what does that represent in terms of what you're trying to do, not just in the theater, but in the whole space?
Part of my lens on cinema is actually, these days, is a bit of therapy from being addicted to your phone. And so it's putting down electronics and engaging in long-form entertainment. And the bar is part of that, to have personal conversations. And also a part of this bar is a focus on board games. So we have about 50 different board games that you can play in the bar. They're for free. And it's, again, that idea of engaging in human interaction and not just staring at the phone.
So that encouragement to put down your phone definitely continues on into the theaters at the Alamo, where staff members are known to boot moviegoers out for using their device during a film. Tim takes me up an escalator to the main hallway. It's lined with vintage movie posters. Some are in French, some are in Italian, some are in Spanish. Then we dipped into an empty theater.
I was just at CinemaCon, and I was test driving all the seats. Oh, man.
On your, there. No, it's down here.
There we go.
Somewhere.
I'm reclining. Oh, super, very comfy. I haven't had a seat this good in an airplane in my life. This would be very nice. So I'd be very comfortable if the movie was good, and be very comfortable to take a nap if the movie wasn't.
We don't go full into horizontal mode. That does be defeating the purpose of movie watching.
I'm visiting the new Alamo Drafthouse movie theater complex in downtown LA. I just sampled their comfy seats with Alamo founder Tim League. We pick up our conversation now at the bar, which is filled with even more movie posters and a handful of arcade games as well.
You have a couple of collaborators in this project, Vidiots, the video store, and Neon, which is a distribution company. Describe the partnerships and what you hope you get out of them, and maybe what they get out of associating with Alamo.
We got to know the Vidiots team for the past several years, and I really believe in their mission. I was a child of the 80s, and the video store experience was really important to me in kind of developing me as a movie nerd. And I miss that aspect of having this huge archive of deep, deep movies available at my beck and call anytime, any weekend. And, you know, even Netflix, there's just not that many. There's like maybe 500 or so movies before 1980 on the platform. So here at Video Vortex, we have 42,000. So, and Vidiots is the king of that mission. So they formed a nonprofit, and the idea is to further their mission, to do fundraising for them, to do programming partnerships with them so that they can raise money to build their own brick and mortar and revive the Vidiots video store on their terms.
And so you don't see it as competition. You see it as kind of encouraging film loving.
Yeah.
Come see a movie here, take a movie home.
I don't have any time for competition within this industry, honestly. I admire anybody in exhibition that's doing good work and loving movies, and it's just not the language that we use. We like to collaborate. There's other theaters that we're friendly with, the New Bev, Downtown Independent. Like we want to support and not be a jerk. So.
And what about Neon?
Neon, for me, started maybe about 7 years ago. For 5 years, we had a company called Drafthouse Films, and we released under that banner 45 independent films, documentaries, foreign language, American indies, and foreign indies. But at the same time, I've been friends with this guy, Tom Quinn, who ran Radius and was at Magnolia before, longtime collaborators in promotion, love his taste. And I was out looking to raise money to take Drafthouse Films to, because I was self-financing Drafthouse Films. And if you know anything about distribution, it's a really... It's like high stakes poker, and that's with really bad odds. That doesn't sound good for an investor pitch. But anyway, I was looking for money to raise the profile of Drafthouse Films. So was Tom, and so we figured that out together because we were roommates at Cannes, and then made a handshake deal to partner and merge those two forces together.
So when you have worked in distribution and exhibition, when you've worked basically both sides of the coin, so to speak. What do you learn, and what are the things that bother you most about the business right now? Setting aside streaming competition, What are the things that you wish would go away that are an impediment to people coming to theaters and enjoying movies?
Ooh, an impediment. I can tell you the frustrations of distribution is that it's really expensive to, you know, get the word out there about a movie. So I love to, you know, support smaller films that maybe don't have the big Lion King type of budget. But then how do you raise above the noise of online, of all the messages that people get? So that's just an inherent challenge to the business. The reason why I got into the business in the first place is we're growing, and so we have this engine of promotion for in theater to our community where we can make a real difference on independent films. And so that's what I want to see happen with the great movies at Neon, but also the great movies at Kino Lorber and IFC and Magnolia. When we love a movie, we want to be able to make a difference with it.
I met you at the Sundance Film Festival this past January, and I will say there are not a lot of exhibitors I know who are attending film festivals. And I'm wondering, when you think about what you want for yourself and what you want from your staff, how important is it that people are looking at new works, that are attending festivals, and you actually have relationships with filmmakers where you follow their careers and make sure that if it makes sense that you can promote their films in your theaters?
It's absolutely critical to me. I mean, not just me, but we send a team to Sundance, to Toronto, to Cannes. And another part of our business is we started a festival called Fantastic Fest. And one of the main drivers of that festival is to do anything we can to support young, interesting genre filmmakers from all over the globe. We've had some really amazing talent come through. So Midsommar is a really interesting example because Ari came to the theater.
Ari Aster.
So he came with his short Strange Thing About the Johnsons, which he did right before Hereditary. And he had a great time at the festival, but we became friends. And, you know, I'm invested in making sure that we can do our part to help support his career. And that's true of any great talent that comes through the festival or that we meet at Sundance. Like, it's exciting to be able to play a small role in that trajectory.
Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next on The Frame, we visit the locations that were used for Quentin Tarantino's 1969 story, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Quentin Tarantino's much-anticipated Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is set in 1969, opens this week. In fact, you can see it tonight. Critics are praising the movie's recreations of the era. And to find out how the filmmakers captured Hollywood from 50 years ago, The Frame contributor Tim Grieving took a tour with two of Tarantino's key collaborators.
I meet location manager Rick Schuler and production designer Barbara Ling at a very 2019 Starbucks in the corner of Sunset and Gower. We all hop in a car together, and they take me on a trip through Hollywood, back in time.
Hollywood is a destination now, and we wanted to create more than that. It's like you get here and you go, well, where is Hollywood? Well, it's kind of an idea. And this movie was making it a place more so than anything else has done before.
Right now, in front of the what is now the Aquarius Theater, rebirthed on Sunset Boulevard, we recreated at least one section of the building. This is where Hair premiered in the 60s. We had painters doing this, and they told me, they said, you know, this has to be the most fun project because people stop all day long and just scream up to them, thank you for putting it back.
We drive down Sunset and stop in front of the famous Cinerama Dome.
Barbara, were you surprised at how any of these places retained their 50-year-old characteristics, or was it a huge to-do to turn back time?
It was a huge to-do to turn back time. It's unfortunate that in L.A. we tear down as much as and as fast as we can of any of the old iconic pieces. The few that we have left, like the Cinerama Dome, the very facade, the marquee is still the original, and the golf ball top. But of course, in that time frame, there was nothing but parking lots on either side of it. So you have, you know, we did the premiere of Krakatoa here, but you could only shoot tight in because you had, of course, this whole world around it now that looks nothing like the 60s, but at least there's a little piece of something left. But that was rare.
Now we're in the touristy heart of Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard, tempted to go inside a famous restaurant for a midday martini.
Musso and Frank's featured in a big way in the movie. We repainted and did all kinds of things there. The nice thing about that restaurant is that they've preserved pretty much the integrity of everything that's there, from the leather and the booths to all of that kind of stuff. So that was a wonderful gem to find. What's to the left of it, however, the Cabo Cantina, all of that got stripped off, from the straw awning to all the signage and everything, and the Vogue Theater used to extend in front of that, so we put the Vogue Theater back in right there. And then over here, or in front of Barbara, at this hologram place here, we used to be the Pussycat Theater, and we turned that back to the Pussycat, put the whole facade back on there, and people were like, whoa, what is this?
Shutting down Hollywood Boulevard for 2 days wasn't an easy feat. To convince the city officials and business owners, Rick Shuler knew he'd need to bring in a big gun, Quentin Tarantino.
He goes, well, Rick, do you think you can get Hollywood Boulevard, like shut down nine blocks for 2 days in a row? And I'm thinking, I think I can get there 70% of the way, but I think if you come and speak to your enthusiasm about having grown up in Hollywood, owning a theater in Hollywood, doing a movie about Hollywood, and that'll probably be a tipping point. And so he was willing to come. And then they had us leave the room, and a minute later I walked back in, and it was a unanimous vote. They were like, if he's going to show up, you know, we'll do it.
Tarantino not only grew up in Los Angeles, he now owns the historic Revival movie theater, the New Beverly, which came in handy when prepping Shuler and Ling for this film.
He'd invite us to his theater, and he'd show us movies from the 70s. And I forget the name, and maybe Barbara can remember that one Don Sutherland movie where it was total carnage on Hollywood Boulevard.
In this trailer for the 1970 film Alice in Wonderland, Sutherland plays a hippie film director who's perched in a crane above a very smoggy Hollywood Boulevard. In front of the Musso and Frank sign and the old Vogue marquee, bombs are exploding, soldiers are spraying machine guns everywhere, and men in tuxedos are dancing on top of a flaming car.
Donald Sutherland is Alex, and Wonderland is Hollywood.
I got a picture of that and took that to my meeting and said, okay, here's what you've done before, and I promise we won't do this kind of carnage.
Where are we now?
So we're El Coyote, which has a lot of pieces left of the original facade. And it's extremely iconic place in the 60s. So it was a must for Quentin, who, who I might add still loves going to, Musso's gave us the longest shutdown of anyone ever trying, because he actually in everyday life loves going to Musso's. So they're, he's a customer that they know well.
Is there any attempt to preserve anything historic in Hollywood?
I don't even know if there's a preservation board anymore.
There's an L.A. Conservancy that tries to. There are individuals that very much try to, but there's not a strong force that really does much of that.
Which means, if you want to see what Hollywood looked like 50 years ago, you're going to have to do it at the movies. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
That is our show for today. If you subscribe to our weekly email newsletter, you can look for it today. If not, you can sign up now at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.